The first case for argument this morning is 162616 Praxair v. Mallinckrodt. And we've got a cross appeal here too. Mr. Peterson, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. Your Honor, William Peterson on behalf of the appellant, cross appellee, Praxair Distribution Incorporated. In the main appeal, which concerns only Claim 9, the board erred in three respects. First, dependent Claim 9 was not briefed separately by Mallinckrodt and should not have been addressed separately by the board. Second, the board failed to give the phrase in accordance with its broadest reasonable interpretation. And third, even under the board's construction, the board incorrectly analyzed obviousness.
Would you mind going to the third point first? Because that's the one I think has most heft to it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very gladly. It's recognized in the specification and in the board's opinion, page 40 of the joint appendix, that pulmonary edema was a known life-threatening side effect that could occur when patients with left ventricular dysfunction were treated with inhaled nitric oxide. So Claim 9 consists of a recommendation and, under the board's construction, a based on that recommendation step, which involve instructing a doctor to discontinue a treatment when a known life-threatening side effect of that treatment results.
And discontinuing the treatment is the only distinguishing factor over claims that have been held invalid.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And really, from our perspective, this is simply common sense. It's the first principle of medicine. First of all, do no harm. When a life-threatening treatment results, doctors don't need to be instructed, or life-threatening side effect results, doctors don't need to be instructed that one of the options available to them is to discontinue that treatment.
Well, what was the board's conclusion with respect to why this was non-obvious? Because there was nothing in the prior art that suggested discontinuance under these circumstances?
Well, I think that's right, but we actually think the board misread some of the art that it discussed, both the Bernasconi reference and the INOT 22 study.
Did the board find a functional relationship between discontinuing and the other steps?
The board found a functional relationship between the recommendation to discontinue treatment and the discontinuing of the treatment, based on its construction of in accordance with as requiring a causal link between the two. And so for that reason, it gave patentable weight to the recommendation. But again, we think discontinuing is obvious and recommending discontinuance is obvious for the very same reasons. The evidence the board pointed to in the prior art, the INOT 22 study, the Bernasconi, the board said that those references didn't teach excluding patients from treatment with inhaled nitric oxide when they had left ventricular dysfunction. But that's simply not what Claim 9 requires.
I'm not sure I understand. How would this patent be enforced? Is it a matter of putting on the label of the competing product the mode of use, that is to discontinue treatment? Is that where the infringement would arise?
Well, this is a method claim.
But the physicians are practicing the method, so they discontinue treatment. How does that benefit your client? I mean, how would it be implemented? You can't license every physician in the nation or every pediatrician. So is it a matter of the label on the product?
Yes, I believe that's the case. It would be the label on the product being the providing the recommendation step.
So it would be an inducement or contributory theory?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the direct infringer would be the physician who discontinues treatment, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But from our perspective, if you look at the Inomax label, what you'll see is it actually recommends discontinuing treatment based on another known side effect of inhaled nitric oxide therapy. So under KSR, when a physician's looking at the options available to them, when a known side effect of inhaled nitric oxide therapy occurs, one of the options available to them already in the prior art was the discontinuance of treatment.
Okay, you're into your rebuttal, so which I know you want to save for the cross appeal. So
thank you.
Let's hear from the other side.
May it please the court. Ken Schuler on behalf of Mallinckrodt. This court should affirm the board's determination that Claim 9 is patentable, and with it enter judgment that Claim 11, which is dependent upon Claim 9, is likewise patentable. The board's determination that the Berlusconi reference, which is the lone reference that was cited by Praxair below, does not teach or suggest the discontinuing step is supported by substantial evidence.
Well, if there's a life-threatening event, so what this patent adds, the added limitation is if there's some life-threatening occurrence based on the dosage, then you discontinue. I mean, I know common sense has been somewhat of a controversial notion in some of our case law here with regard to KSR, but isn't this really a common sense, common occurrence?
I think not for, four reasons, and if the court will indulge me, the first might be the most important might be the specification itself. In the INOT 22 study, if you look at Table 7, there were two instances of pulmonary edema during the course of the study. The Table 7 indicates in neither instance was the treatment discontinued. So it was not common wisdom or commonsensical to these physicians to discontinue the treatment. The second point is this is a life-threatening condition that it's indicated for, the neonates that have hypoxic respiratory failure. And so a physician, it's not common sense to discontinue something that's saving the neonate. Third, the board looked at all the evidence and said they concluded that Berlusconi does not teach or suggest discontinuing INO treatment in neonates. It merely says that there's a need for monitoring during INO treatment in adults. Now, there's two important things there. The first is our expert explained, Dr. Rosenthal explained, that Berlusconi is a study involving adults. That is not applicable to neonates, who are not little adults. They have fundamentally different pulmonary vasculature systems.
Mr. Schuler, I'd like to interrupt your 4 points and get to the cross appeal. I think your argument is that the board should not have discarded the steps of providing information and recommendation as printed matter. Isn't printed matter simply an abstract idea reduced to writing?
That's one potential way to look at it. I think that in this instance, we know that there's a functional relationship between that printed matter and the remaining steps of the method for a multitude of reasons.
Well, what's a functional relationship?
Well, that's a very good question, Your Honor. I think a functional relationship is one that's
making a recommendation doesn't make something happen. They don't work together.
Well, they do have to work together. I think that there's two interesting examples in the specification that establish that there is a functional relationship. In other words, a causal functional relationship between the information of Clause 2 and the remaining steps of the method. And the first of those examples is the INOT 22 study. As the court may recall, the study protocol originally indiscriminately allowed for the administration of the nitric oxide gas to the patients regardless of whether they had left ventricular dysfunction.
But as a matter of law, does the functional relationship test, if we can call it that, survive ALICE? Because abstract subject matter is abstract subject matter, and printed matter is mental steps, abstract subject matter reduced to writing. So does that survive ALICE?
I think it does, because if there's a functional relationship with physical steps, and here there is, even with Claim 1, remember, Claim 1 specifies that the information has to be sufficient to cause a physician who's otherwise considering using the nitric oxide gas to elect not to treat one or more of the neonates. That sufficient to cause means that it's specifying a reaction by the physician and one that is causally related, sufficient to cause. In the INOT 22 study, that's exactly what happened. The information that was provided to the physicians, they were given the gas and one set of exclusion criteria. After the protocol was revised, they were given the gas with a different set of exclusion criteria. And there was an empirical benefit in terms of substantial increase in safety. There was a reduction in the number of adverse events. That was set forth in our declarant, Dr. Rosenthal's declaration, explaining that empirically the information caused a benefit in terms of a reduction in adverse events. So I don't think that ALICE would implicate the doctrine in that fashion. So long as there's a functional relationship with other physical steps, then it is patentable subject matter. The board also, I think, misread the specification in a second respect. There's additional evidence of a functional relationship, and that is that the information at issue in Clause 2 empirically led the FDA to change the labeling. The information that the patients with LVD could suffer from pulmonary edema led to the labeling revision, and that's explained in the specification as well. The other error, I really think the most apt case for the court to consider is the Levin case. There, the court found a functional relationship between color coding for expiration dates on a pharmaceutical product and the product itself.
Which case is that?
In Re Levin. That's 1997 Westlaw 44797. So the court explained the color-coded expiration indicia provides information about the drug, i.e. the substrate. And the same is true here. The information in the clause provides information.
Did you cite that case in your brief?
It's in our reply brief.
Not in the red.
Okay. I think it's in both reply briefs. Okay. I think it was originally cited by Praxair, and we cited it as well. And so there's information in that tells you, tells the physician information about the drug, i.e. who it can be safely administered to. The court found a functional relationship.
Well, what about AstraZeneca and King? Didn't at least one of those cases deal with instruction or
information? Yeah, I think that's distinguishable on multiple grounds. The first is there was nothing really tying the instructions to the method. It was just, you know, give the drug. Here, Claim 1, again, explicitly says that the information has to be sufficient to cause a reaction by a physician. So Claim 1 itself recites a functional relationship. I think in AstraZeneca there was really no tie between the kit and the I think it was butanide.
You say there's a functional relationship between providing information and recommendation between that and the physical steps. But what are the physical steps providing nitric oxide? This almost sounds like Mayo. Minor physical steps and abstract ideas.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think that there's supplying the INO, there's obtaining the INO, and there's supplying to the physician. And again, Claim 1 recites that there has to be information sufficient to cause a reaction by the physician. In other words, the physician who is otherwise considering giving the drug to a patient with LVD elects not to treat them. So that's a physical reaction, and I think that that's not abstract at all. I think that's
you're not claiming a method of treatment of this ailment with nitric oxide.
Not in this.
No, that's
patent, other than Claim 9.
That's in the prior art.
Claim 9 does involve treatment. But with regard to our cross appeal, I think you're correct, Your Honor, that claims 1 through 8 are not explicitly a method of treatment. They're a method of supplying the nitric oxide gas.
So what you've added to the prior art is providing information and a recommendation, abstract ideas.
Well, I don't agree in the sense that if you look at the study, you might call it an abstract idea, but it resulted in a physical change of multiple steps. In other words, the physician stopped treating those patients that had pre-existing LVD, and as Dr. Rosenthal explained, it led to a substantial improvement in the safety attributes. Now, the board made an observation, Your Honor, that the drug inherently causes this effect. Well, if that's true, the only way to make it safer is to change physician behavior with information. You can't make the drug itself any safer. And so, in a real-world sense, not an abstract sense, the way that safety gets implemented in the medical field is by educating physicians about things.
So what is it in the claims other than Claim 9? So they say providing information, and then where is the language about what they're going to do with this information?
In which claim?
I'm asking you. I mean, Claim 1. I mean, the claims
claim
other. What I said is other than Claim 9, because we've
sure.
already dealt with that.
In Claim 1,
yes.
There is the
so it's part 2.
Clause. Claim 1 mandates that the information in Clause 2 be, quote, sufficient to cause a medical provider considering inhaled nitric oxide treatment for a plurality of neonatal patients who are A, suffering from a condition for which inhaled nitric oxide is indicated, and B, have pre-existing left ventricular dysfunction to elect to avoid treating one or more of the plurality of patients with inhaled nitric oxide to avoid putting them at risk for pulmonary edema.
So the action it causes is to allow the physician to consider doing this?
to elect not to treat those patients.
Elect. So it doesn't say you have to do it or this is necessarily required. It says to elect to avoid treatment.
Well, I think sufficient cause is both causal and establishes a functional relationship. The information has to be sufficient to cause a reaction by the physician, and we think that that is exactly what a functional relationship is. The claim recites it, and the specification supports that there's a functional relationship between the specific information at issue and the safe and effective administration of nitric oxide. Briefly, I'm going to just very briefly, and I'll save the rest of my time. There was also a procedural error by the board. They adopted a construction of pharmaceutically acceptable in its final decision that neither party had promulgated or proffered. Under SAS, that's plain error. We never got an opportunity to argue to the board non-obviousness under the construction that neither party had.
How can there be a real question about what pharmaceutically acceptable means?
Well, neither party thought that there was, Your Honor, and the board adopted a construction that neither party had proffered, and frankly, we don't see in any case law. More interestingly, the board didn't cite any affirmative evidence for its construction. It dealt with our evidence, intrinsic and extrinsic, and said they dismissed
it. It almost seems like a silly question to me. And it either is physically capable of being administered to a person, and is acceptable in terms of toxicity, efficacy. It's an established term.
We thought it was too, Your Honor, and that's the construction we proffered. The board came up with a different
one. The difference is you were proffering the inclusion of the word safe, and there was evidence, I think even by your expert, that the board pointed to, that would be kind of a roving term that could be changed just based on the science and the information, and that's what was troubling about adding that particular term, right?
I think that was their reason. I think it's misguided because the construction never changes. Pharmaceutically acceptable has the same meaning. What might be in an FDA label, he admitted, does change over time. But remember, the information is already specified in the claim. So the claim's not going to change, right? The clause 2 specifies what information would
be. So what is the import of the difference? They said pharmaceutically acceptable. You said pharmaceutically safe and acceptable?
We said suitably safe for pharmaceutical use. Yeah. They said
so what's the difference between the two, in your view?
I think that Praxair is construing it to be that it's pharmaceutical grade. I don't think that that's a reasonable construction. Morphine, you know, I can hand somebody morphine, and it might be pharmaceutical grade morphine. That doesn't make it pharmaceutically acceptable without information about its safe and effective administration and its addictive properties. I don't think anybody would think that that's reasonable to just hand somebody some morphine and say it's acceptable because it's pharmaceutical grade. It doesn't have any undue toxicity, and it's not laced with fentanyl. That's not suitable for pharmaceutical use. The procedural point, though, is the board never gave us a chance to argue under its construction for the patentability of claims 1 through 8.
So did you request rehearing from the board either side?
We did not. Given that that Praxair was appealing Claim 9, we decided to appeal to this court and cross-appeal. So with
okay.
that, I'll
you
just...
want to save your rebuttal time on your cross-appeal.
Thank you. Your Honor, what I heard from my friend, an argument about sufficient to cause actually requiring the result to actually take place in Claim 1 is, I think, a claim construction that I certainly didn't see in Mallinckrodt's brief, and it's certainly a claim construction that was never argued to the board. Today is the first time that Mallinckrodt has suggested that the language of Claim 1, that the information must be sufficient to cause a medical provider to elect to avoid treating, must actually require a medical provider to elect to avoid treating. But when you look at the language of Claim 1, the steps there are simply obtaining a cylinder containing compressed nitric oxide, supplying the cylinder, and providing information. There's no requirement in Claim 1 that actually requires a patient to be treated, much less a provider to actually make a decision to treat or not to treat based on the information. You need to provide information that is sufficient to cause that result, but Claim 1 doesn't actually require that result, and until today, Mallinckrodt has never argued that it has. Now, the other argument I heard from my friend is that a functional relationship can be shown empirically. That is, you can look at how a patent is actually practiced and see whether information in practice changes the results of one step, changes decisions that are made by physicians. This court rejected that in In Re Cao. That's 639 F3rd 1057. It's a case the board relied on, and we think it's the right guidance for how this court and the board should conduct a functional relationship analysis.
If the functional relationship relates to information, does that survive Alice?
If the information has a functional relationship, actually causes a physical change in the active steps of the patent.
How does information change a physical step?
Well, I think the board's construction of Claim 9 is probably one in which the functional analysis was correct. Again, we think the board erred in its obviousness under Claim 9, and we think the board erred in its construction of it in accordance with. But under the board's construction, the physician actually has to make a decision to treat or not treat as a result of its consideration of information. And at least in this court's precedent, when you have that link between the information and the accomplishment of physical steps.
So that's decision, another an additional limitation. It's not just providing the information, but it's compelling or requiring some action as a result of the information. And that's the difference, in your view, I assume, between Claim 9 and the other claims.
Absolutely. And at least on the board's, again, what we think is an erroneous construction of Claim 9. And when you look at Cao, that's
so going back to Claim 9 just briefly, I know you want to respond to the other thing. So your view of Claim 9 is, so let's assume there is a functional relationship, and we're not talking about excluding that, but your argument would be, nonetheless, it's obvious.
Yes, Your Honor, both the information and the discontinuance as a result of that information. But turning to the other claims, we think that causal relationship between the physical steps and the information is what's lacking from the claims. We were talking about this in respect to Mao. Mao says you can't take a law of nature and patent the claims that simply say apply the law of nature. This is frankly a claim that says tell someone about a law of nature and keep on doing what you were doing anyway without it actually affecting you. So when you look at the Cao case, that's another case where the claims required providing information and providing a therapeutically effective amount of an oral release dosage form, in that case of oxymorphone. And the patent owner there made arguments that were remarkably similar to Mallinckrodt's empirical arguments here. They said, well, look, in practice, having that information changes what the therapeutically amount of the dose is, and therefore you can come up with some sort of functional relationship, even though there's not really one in the claims. And this court rejected it. Actually, emphasized in the opinion was nothing in the claims requires that the dosage be adjusted in response to the providing of information. So Mallinckrodt hasn't claimed any sort of change in what the physician does.
So help us out a little, because our cases, and even one of our cases, maybe King, where the case initially went down by the district court on a 101 analysis, our court changed the analysis, I think it was King, and went into an obviousness analysis. And obviously, Judge Lurie and I agree with him, there's a feel of a 101 here and a Mayo claim with respect to information. So how would you recommend that we resolve this, on the traditional printed matter functional relationship, or necessarily because of Mayo and recent Supreme Court cases, we should add in a mental step analysis?
Well, I think you should resolve it as a form of printed matter. And it's well within the printed matter doctrine. Simply to say that steps under DiStefano, which claim the content of information, do not give patentable, are not given patentable weight, can't be used to distinguish claims from the prior art, unless that information, whether it's provided, evaluated, received, considered, is functionally related, has some physical effect on one of the active physical steps of the patent. And in that regard, let me actually turn to my friend's discussion of pharmaceutically acceptable, because Judge Lurie, we agree wholeheartedly with the construction that you suggested, which is what we think the board construed it as. Now, obviously, we don't believe pharmaceutically acceptable is limiting at all, but if it's going to be limiting, the board construed it the right way, which is simply a physically safe, physically non-toxic.
Well, is that
substance.
I mean, your friend is making it first, in the first instance, a procedural argument, a process argument with respect to their not having had the opportunity to respond. What was the, so you weren't proposing the construction that the board ultimately adopted, were you?
We didn't propose that construction. What we have done is consistently opposed the limitation that Mallinckrodt seeks to impose through pharmaceutically acceptable. And when they say pharmaceutically acceptable must be safe, what they don't mean is physically safe. What they don't mean is non-toxic. You'll see this on page 3962 of the appendix. They agree that pharmaceutically acceptable, the actual content of the cylinder never changes. So pharmaceutically acceptable has nothing to do with physically what the inhaled nitric oxide is. Instead, Mr. Schuler was asked on page 3975 by the board, I'm trying to figure out how pharmaceutically acceptable makes your canister different than any other canister that's out there. And what he answered was, it's the information that goes with it. So what Mallinckrodt's been saying is pharmaceutically acceptable doesn't mean physically safe. It means safe because you are given information that allows it to be used safely. Praxair has consistently opposed that, primarily by arguing that the preamble is not limiting. And critically here, this is not a situation in which the board adopted a construction of pharmaceutically acceptable in its institution decision, and then, without notice to the parties, changed that construction in its final written decision or at the hearing. That's what we think happened with respect to Claim 9, where both parties agreed with the construction in the institution decision, and then at the hearing, the board proposed a new construction without notice. There was no construction of pharmaceutically acceptable in the institution decision. Mallinckrodt briefed its arguments about the meaning of pharmaceutically acceptable at length in the patent owner's response. Mallinckrodt knew going into the hearing that the correctness of this construction and the limitations imposed by pharmaceutically acceptable were in dispute. The board considered those arguments and simply found them wanting. In that regard, we do think this is perhaps most similar to the Intellectual Ventures 2 versus Ericsson case, this court's May 8th decision from 2017. So we don't see any procedural issues here with construction of pharmaceutically acceptable. But let's assume Mallinckrodt's right. If you accept Mallinckrodt's construction of pharmaceutically acceptable, it still doesn't create the sort of functional relationship between the informational steps and the active steps of the claims. Mallinckrodt's construction simply transforms pharmaceutically acceptable itself into a printed matter limitation. Because under Mallinckrodt's construction, pharmaceutically acceptable is claiming the content of information. It's pharmaceutically acceptable depending on whether or not there's particular information that goes along with the inhaled nitric oxide. So with Claim 1, for example, Mallinckrodt would then need to show a functional relationship between the pharmaceutically acceptable nitric oxide and the physical steps of obtaining and supplying nitric oxide. And Mallinckrodt hasn't attempted to make that link. So in our view, however you end up construing pharmaceutically acceptable, if you accept the board's view, it's not a printed matter limitation. It's a physical limitation. But there's no functional relationship between that physical limitation and the informational steps. If you accept Mallinckrodt's construction, well, printed matter becomes an informational step. And there's no functional relationship between that informational step and the physical steps of obtaining and supplying what...
Although the board obviously never had to reach that analysis because they construed it differently, right?
No, Your Honor, I didn't need to go down that route. Unless the panel has further questions, I think I've made the points I'd like to make.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Briefly, I think that there was some suggestion that we had not argued the sufficient to cause language. That's at page 38 of our brief on appeal. And I think it's clear what the plain language of the claim means. Counsel made a point about not transforming the canister or the cylinder of gas, and I think that's a misguided point. This is not a product claim. The printed matter doesn't have to transform the product. It's a method claim. And so the question is whether the information, the printed matter, transforms the known method of supplying the gas. And we know that it did, because prior to the transformation, the printed matter being given to the physicians in the study, they were indiscriminately giving the drug to patients that whether or not they had left ventricular dysfunction. There were a series of adverse events that were substantially higher than expected. The printed matter went with the gas, with the revision, okay, supplied the gas to the same physicians with the printed matter that said don't give it to people with LVD, and there was a substantial reduction in the number of severe adverse events. That is an empirical and functional relationship between the printed matter and the supply of the gas. The same gas, but the information changed how the physicians acted, and it changed the safety profile of the drug. And that is the paradigmatic example of a functional relationship.
Thank you. We thank both sides, and the case is submitted.